today I'm here with Jeff Berwick, who runs the Dollar Vigilante. He shows up on the media in quite a few different places. Jeff's originally from Canada. He is a pretty outspoken libertarian and does a lot of business around the world. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Adrian.
So, Jeff, why don't you tell us a little bit about your story? I know quite a bit of it from seeing you posted online, but it sounds like you used to be quite a geek, and now you're a libertarian in Acapulco, Mexico, which is a path I think you didn't expect to take.
No, I didn't. I guess I started out my life in Canada as a very young person and a very cold. I grew up in a place called Edmonton, which I call Deadmonton. It's really, I can't believe anyone lives there. It's that bad. It literally is minus 40 degrees for about half the year, and not a lot to do. So I really got into computers when I was younger, and I think that's really what kind of got me thinking a little bit differently, because I didn't go to school a lot after I got a computer when I was around 12 years old. I would just go for the tests in school, and so I was quite lucky that way, that I avoided a lot of the daytime prison camps for children called public schools. And at the same time, in the evening, I wouldn't be watching the TV programming, and they call it programming for a reason. The media and is almost one and the same with the government nowadays. And in Canada, of course, they don't even try to lie about it. They actually have the CBC. It's the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. It's the government news, just like in the Soviet Union, and no one seems to mind. So I avoided a lot of that, and I was always into computers. So when the internet came out, I was working at a bank, and I thought, I have to do something on the internet. This is just what I've been waiting my whole life for it. And I had been working at a bank, and I was interested in the stock market, so I started a financial website, still the top financial website in Canada, called stockhouse.com. And it started out in my house, and I very quickly quit the bank after that. I actually got offered a job at the bank, or not a job, but I got offered a promotion. I was only 23 years old, and they wanted to make me the bank manager of the branch. And that was a big deal, apparently. They said I was probably one of the youngest people to ever be offered that position. And I sat there for a few seconds and thought about it, and thought about 30 or 40 years working at a bank. And I said, you know, I think I'm just going to quit. And I ended up going off and starting off stockhouse.com. And it was worth about $240 million in 1999, 2000. And then after the Alan Greenspan tech bubble, Y2K bubble burst, it was worth almost nothing. And I decided just to sell it at that point because I was so confused and I was really stressed out. I'd been working on that company for about 8 years straight, 7 days a week, 18 hours a day. And I decided to buy a sailboat, a catamaran, and try to sail around the world. So I didn't know how to sail or anything, but the day I bought it, I just left and tried to sail around the world. So I almost sank it three times on the first night, and I actually ended up sinking it in El Salvador 1 year to the day later. I was actually a pretty good sailor at that point, but it was just a bunch of bad luck and bad timing and bad decisions all at once, which is pretty normal for these sort of things. And but I just kept going for about 4 or 5 years and traveling the world and trying to find out what's going on, both in the financial markets and in politics with government. I didn't have a great understanding of any of it, and so I would spend just almost all day reading on the internet. And I really got into Austrian economics, which really explained why my company, which was worth nothing, then worth $240 million, then worth nothing again, all within a span of a few years, why that happened. It was because of all the money printing, all the counterfeiting being done by Alan Greenspan. And so that really opened my eyes. So I really got into Austrian economics and just read everything I could on that. And I also got into libertarianism and really realized that the biggest problem on Earth today, the biggest problem for humanity, the biggest enemy of mankind is the government and the central banks. These are very horrible, unnecessary evils, especially the central banks. And so I've been really rallying against them ever since about 2009, when I started the Dollar Vigilante, when I talk about the coming dollar collapse, which I expect in the next decade. We'll see exactly when. I hate to make predictions of time, but it's definitely going to happen. It's just a matter of when. And I also rally against the politicians, government, and central banks, and talk about all those issues.
So it's interesting you talk about problems with Alan Greenspan, because Alan Greenspan was one of the original, in Ayn Rand's terminology, was one of the original group members of the collective, and a lot of his policies were built on what Ayn Rand promoted, essentially saying that the market will regulate itself and just leave it alone. But you feel that there was a lot of problems with what he did.
Yeah, it was such a strange thing because he was like good friends with Ayn Rand. He wrote a thing on gold before he was in the Federal Reserve. He said a lot of libertarian type things. And then once he was the chairman of the Federal Reserve, all of a sudden it was like he just forgot all of that and started printing money. And I think everyone's got their own view on it. And I also find it very interesting how he's been talking since he's left the Fed. So he went into the Fed, and all of a sudden you remember he had that old like Greenspan speak. It was basically he'd just say a bunch of nothing that sounded like gobbledygook, and then just walk off. It was really like, bizarre that that anyone listened to him. But
I think that's how most of modern academic research works today as well. Not just Alan Greenspan, but anyway, that's another topic.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see now that he's left, he's actually started to say some things again. He actually has said since he left the Federal Reserve that they should shut down the Federal Reserve. It's very interesting that he would say things like that. And he's talked about gold again. And but when he was working at the Federal Reserve, he was just doing, I think he basically sold out. I think he sold his soul to the devil, the Federal Reserve, and just did whatever for the fame. He ended up being on the front cover of Time magazine as saving the world. I think he sold his soul to the Federal Reserve, but now he seems to be back in the private market, which is a lot more a better moral place to be. And he appears to be saying some interesting things. I think it's going to be, I'm sort of following him and seeing what he's doing next, because it seems like maybe he'll say some more stuff like shut down the Fed. That'd be really interesting. And of course, we just had Ben Bernanke just leave the Fed, thank God. But of course, it always gets worse and worse. And we have Janet Yellen. And I just can't believe that, a man named Helicopter Ben, and he had that name because he did a speech where he said, if the economy gets really bad, what we'll do is we'll take helicopters and drop cash on everybody, which is absolutely insane. And then what's Janet Yellen is even worse. She's a bigger money printer. She says Ben Bernanke has been printing enough money, so it's just we're headed towards hyperinflation. I don't think it's even possible to stop what's going to happen at this point. But the way these people are, it's going to happen even faster than I expect.
What's interesting to me is, because when I first heard you speak, I was at Freedom Fest and I was in the audience there, and you were there with Doug Casey and a few others, and I thought you sounded absolutely insane. And you also speak to get reactions, so I think that as you talk, you do come off a little bit insane, but there's a lot of truth to what you say. And I'm now pretty convinced we're headed for a crash too. I'd be very surprised, in fact, if it doesn't happen. And I think you're 10 years is a long time frame, and it's probably going to be a lot quicker than 10 years.
Yeah, I think this year's going to be incredibly interesting. Last year was quite interesting already with Cyprus, with what happened in Boston, with turning into a police state overnight. A lot of very interesting things happened last year. I think this year there's going to be major problems, probably in the Eurozone. I think Italy and France are going to have some sort of major blow up soon. You're already starting to see it with a lot of banks over there are starting to limit withdrawals, and they're really cracking down on capital controls. We'll see what happens in Japan this year. But yeah, I think a lot of stuff is going to happen a lot quicker than most people think. And the general tendency of these sort of things is they tend to take longer to happen than you think. I try to think of the world economy or the world political systems as being a giant ocean tanker now, because I've learned enough. I've always been early in markets. I was predicting the housing bubble probably 3-4 years earlier before it popped. So I was predicting that 2009 financial crisis probably a couple of years before it happened, and I'm predicting the collapse of the dollar coming pretty soon. So I try to think of it as more like an ocean tanker. These things take a long time to actually come to or end their momentum, but once they do, and once they do hit that island, or like that guy in where was it, Italy, and actually get drunk and flip it over on its side, once that starts to happen, It starts to happen pretty quick. And I think we're going to see more and more an increasing velocity of crazy stuff happening.
Well, I mean, the 2008 crisis almost came out of nowhere, right? It wasn't expected, and then everything was fine and dandy, and then suddenly the crisis happened, and, you know, it hit really hard. And so if we do get a dollar collapse, which I think you're right in suggesting that we will, that it's going to be the same sort of thing. Some unexpected event will come out of somewhere, and then the whole system will start to teeter.
Yeah, you never know where these – there's so many. There's a – literally 7 billion variables on Earth. You never know what's going to set off one sort of chain reaction or another. And that's why when you talk to a lot of Keynesians, a lot of people like that, who believe that you can control the economy, and if you just knew the price of everything, you can kind of control it. It's really crazy because there's so many dynamics in life. It's almost impossible to model anything. And if you look at the Arab Spring as just one example, that all started... we're talking about revolutions all throughout the Middle East that all started in Tunisia with a person who had a very small cart in a market. And the local police, just like any police anywhere, were just thieves and criminals. And they were just robbing him every day. He only made about $2 a day, and they were taking almost $2 a day from him. And he just couldn't survive, and he didn't want to live like that. And he lit himself on fire in Tunisia. And so that one man... lighting himself on fire, set off an entire reaction that's still going on to this day. Now, of course, that would have happened anyway, but it's interesting to see what do set these sort of things off. You never know what's going to happen. I just did a speech and I said, you know, the old saying that, you know, watch out for the black swan. Well, I think the sky is filling with black swans to the point that you can barely see the sun anymore, and I don't know which one of them is going to set it off, but one of them is definitely going to.
Right. And so, I mean, where we're on the same page, I mean, at least you and I are, I think anyway, is that Keynesian economics is the problem because it doesn't account for economic modeling properly. And what we would like to see is a form of economic modeling that doesn't really model. It just lets the market go and do its thing. It'll overheat at times. It'll blow up at times. But because there is much less attempt or even no attempt to manage it, that it will... never escalate into biblical proportions when we get a crash. Does that sound correct?
Yeah, that's generally correct in my opinion. Keynesian economics isn't necessarily the root of the problem. The root of the problem is central banking. Central banking serves no useful purpose other than to enrich the elites and to impoverish almost everybody else. There's no need for a central bank. And it's funny to talk to Americans who... are so unbelievably brainwashed to believe they live in the land of the free, the freest country on earth, when it's almost the least free country on earth right now. But if you're just talking to them and you mention, oh, when you say it's so free, you're talking, you know, it's free markets here? And they'll go, yes. And, you know, it's one of the most controlled markets on earth. But, you know, free markets, a capitalism, a true capitalism, which is just free markets, doesn't have central banks. It doesn't have a violent central bank enforced by violence, which is laws, that you have to use their currency or else. And capitalism and free markets also don't have taxes. And that's, of course, a whole big part of what the government does. But so it's not necessarily that Keynesianism is a problem. It's central banks itself is a problem. We don't need central banks. And that's why I'm actually so excited about Bitcoin, because this is a currency that... for the first time, and we live in a digital age right now, for the first time, we have a currency come out in the digital age from the private market, and it's not controlled by anybody. And that's exactly what you want in a currency. You don't want it to be controlled by a man in a beard in a boardroom who's very private and does whatever he wants. That's Soviet-style central planning, and I can't believe that anyone thinks that's a good thing to do. Now we have Janet Yellen, of course. So. The real problem is the central bank itself and the governments that allow the central bank. Because, of course, without the violence backed by government, we could not have... you could try to start a central bank that forces people to use money, but if you start doing things, you have to compete in the market. So if you start printing up $1 trillion per year and giving it out to your friends, you pretty quickly, people are going to stop using your money. So the central banks and the governments are the biggest problem, and then, of course, you talked about Keynesianism. So now you have a central bank, which is already terrible. And then you have so many people believe, I don't even know if they believe it or not. I can't believe they believe in Keynesianism. Keynesianism is literally insane. If you've read John Maynard Keynes' books, I haven't read them all. I can't get through them because it's almost unbelievably insane. He says things like, if you want to improve the economy, what you can do is you can put money, and when he says money, he means like dollars, paper dollars, into bottles and bury them. And then people will come and they'll have to dig them up, and that will improve the economy because that will improve economic activity. You know, he has a lot of ideas like that, which is patently insane. And then he...
Because that's not producing value.
Right. Yeah, their idea is, and it's nuts, it's totally communist Marxist ideas that, you know, the economy is good if everyone's just working. So by their ideas, if you follow these through logically, then if you really want to improve the economy completely, we should blow up every city on Earth every year. And then we're all going to be so busy rebuilding those cities that we'll all be rich.
Hmm. So what they're not doing is they're not accounting for the production of value. And
that's
really,
right.
True economic modeling is actually modeling human behavior, which is how we work together and produce value.
Right. And a real true good economy. And I hate to even use the word economy because really it's just life. For things to be quite prosperous, a lot of people need to be producing things the market wants. A lot of these ideas that they have, they think, well, we just need to be spending money, which makes no sense. I think a five-year-old kid can understand why Keynesian economics is literally just crazy, like absolutely crazy. If you just tell a little kid, do you think you'll get rich by just spending all your money on candy? The kid be like, no. And that's all they're saying. And it's unbelievable that people believe this stuff. And you look at Keynes again, he had so many ridiculous ideas. And I think he knew they were ridiculous. I think he was just grasping for power and just writing whatever he thought any politician would buy. But it's funny that one of his main sort of tenets is, well, in the end, we're all dead anyway. You know, this is a guy who's trying to write some sort of scientific style economic document. And he uses words like animal spirits. So whenever he couldn't explain something, he'd just go, well, sometimes it's just animal spirits. I can't believe anyone believes that stuff.
Well, it's a moral viewpoint. I think it's not necessarily science. It's just a moral viewpoint. So among my friends, I'm the one that often annoys them because I tend to have the most right-wing view of anybody. But I now need to ask you some left-wing questions. Which embarrasses me a little bit, but some of the things that if you're suggesting that we have no central bank, no monitoring, any of that sort of stuff, essentially we go back to the U.S. economy of the 1900s, we're going to have, I hate this word inequality. It makes me want to stab myself in the eye sometimes when I hear it, but we are going to have a lot more inequality. It's going to make it harder for society to work together if certain groups get too far behind. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think we would have a lot less inequality if we actually had free markets. The governments and the central banks, they've been demolishing the middle class and keeping tens of, or even hundreds of millions, you could probably say, of people in the U.S. in poverty now for decades, ever since the war on poverty. All their wars, the war of terror, all their wars actually create the things that they actually want. The war on drugs, that's just created more drugs, and it's crazy whenever government gets involved, it's just heinous and horrible. And they've created an entire tens of millions of people have been in abject poverty, driven into it through all these systems like minimum wage laws, which actually create make it so that there's much more unemployment. Things like welfare, which is a very dangerous thing. And if you get someone into welfare, I'll give you one example. If I was younger, and I remember thinking about this when I was 16 and I was playing video games, if I knew that I would just get a check every month for $2,000 and that would buy me all the pizza I want and I could play video games all day, I'd probably still be there playing that game. And after a few generations of that, you can just see how it really will make it so. It actually incentivizes that you don't actually produce anything. It actually incentivizes that you don't learn anything or improve yourself.
You know where you can see that most profoundly is in the indigenous populations, the Inuits in Canada, Aboriginals in Australia, and a lot of different, the Indians in the US. They have more problems with alcoholism and other, all sorts of other stuff, because they get lots of handouts and they never have to go and work really hard. I feel really terrible for them, because I think the same way. If I could have just sat on my butt and gotten a lot of money every month and not have to do anything, then that would be great.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's really sad. I have some Indian blood in me, and actually where I grew up, there was quite a few natives, and I kind of knew the community fairly well. And the natives that kind of somehow got off the reservation, they were great. I actually know what I knew. I have a friend in Saskatchewan. I don't even know if you know where that is, but anyway, he's a entrepreneur. He's a Native American, and he's a great guy. He's kicking ass. And then you go to the reservations where these people have been on welfare for generations, and it's totally correct. Like, if you want to really destroy a person, give them welfare. Because if you think about life, you know, it's not easy to improve yourself, but you want to, and if you have to, and I'm not saying it's good to force people to get better, but in life, that's just life. If you want to eat and you have no food and you have no money, you better go out and figure out how to make some money or get some food. And if that's given to you, it just drives any sort of incentive out of a wanting to improve yourself. And, you know, business is not easy. I'm a entrepreneur, and there's no way that I would do all these things I do if I was going to have most of it taken away from me, which I would if I live in the U.S., which has the highest corporate tax rates in the world. But I do all my things offshore and all legally, so I don't have to pay any tax. But it's just, I have I try to explain it this way to people. If you don't have incentives, if you try to make everything equal, so let's say you're at a poker table, and you know, normally a poker game's great, and there's people coming and going, some people are winning, some people are losing, but everyone's into the game, everyone's interested, it's a dynamic game, and if you really apply yourself, you can get better and do better at poker. If you came to the poker table and said to everybody, okay, we're going to take all the chips away, or we're actually just going to give you all, actually, we'll just give you all the same amount of chips, but then at the end of every hand, no matter what happens, you get your chips back. That game, within 30 seconds, would be almost over. Like, no one would care, and why am I playing this? If you actually left them in a room for a year, by the end of the year, none of them would even know how to play poker anymore, because they'd have no interest in it, because they'd have no reason to even care about the game. But if you give incentive, which is just what the free market is, where you have the opportunity to earn more if you work harder, that really improves most people's lives. And it's just a fact of life. And all you're doing with things like welfare and all that kind of stuff is ruining people. And of course, you're taking money as well with taxes from people who are productive and giving it to people who are not productive. And that's a terrible thing to do. If anything, you should do the opposite, because what we need is a lot more producers, a lot of people to produce wealth. That's how this world gets much better, is by producing wealth. And all these government programs, central banks and taxes and regulations, all they do is destroy wealth.
So I take all of your points there. And again, I have to put my embarrassing left-wing side on display. One of the things that's really exciting that's happening now is that we're getting more leverage than we ever had. I mean, if you think of the leverage that there was in the 19th century, I mean, we had Rockefeller and Carnegie and some of these guys. I mean, they had to patch companies together, statewide companies, into form a national corporation, because that sort of stuff wasn't possible then. Whereas now I can make a national corporation very easily. But where we are today with people like Mark Zuckerberg can sit on top of Facebook and drive social networking worldwide as one guy sitting out there in California. And so the economies of scale that we're getting are getting broader and broader and broader. And so I agree with everything you're saying on welfare and how it destroys people, but it seems to me that we still can't leave everybody or a lot of people behind, because if we do, then society starts to collapse. One of the things that I've been looking into more recently is when you actually look at what goes on in the left, whether it's feminism or communism or even religion. I think Jesus, as he came along, was fundamentally about unseating a lot of different dynamics that were going on 2,000 years ago. He was helping the poor and the impoverished. He wasn't hanging out with the rich and the elites. What I see from all of these different movements is that they don't have the ability to necessarily produce stuff. They just have they essentially have a veto button that can blow everything up.
Yeah, you know, you bring up some interesting points. Let's take Facebook as an example. And I was actually with a person having a business meeting, and he gave me this example. And he said, you know, so I see a lot of these very, very rich people. And he goes, that makes me sick. And I was like, why? And he's like, well, I think, you know, there's a lot of poor people too. And I'm like, yeah. I don't get your point, though. Why do you hate these rich people? Now, I understand if they got their wealth through things like evil things like government or through the central banks, and they're like working with those guys. But if they actually produced wealth, then why would you dislike that person? And he said, you know, they could go to a dinner and they could spend like $50,000 on food, and you know, meanwhile people are out in the street starving. And I'm like, well, who cares if they spend $50,000 on a dinner? That's actually, you know, I'd love to own that restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. Come and be a customer.
Yeah, it's like he almost had in his mind like that he's eating like $50,000 worth of food, like 1,000 steaks, and there's like it's not humanly possible. And if, you know, a lot of people get very confused about wealth and why and equality and poor people and how we can help poor people. The best way to help poor people, first of all, is get the government's boot off of their necks. Get rid of all the government programming programs like minimum wage, which should make it almost impossible. I just watched a video just the other day. Milton Friedman said that minimum wage is the most racist policy he ever saw. This was recorded like 40 years ago. He actually called black people Negroes or something. So that kind of shows you what decade it was. But he was saying that that really was a racist policy because it made it so that a lot of people in the black community couldn't get work because a lot of them were underskilled at the time. That may have changed now, I don't know. But so the best way to help the poor people is to get rid of all of these horrible things. The central banks, they're printing up tons of money. That money first goes to the financial elites and the government. And so they get the benefit of that new money. By the time it trickles down, and they always use the word trickle down, by the time it gets really to a person who doesn't have a lot of money, all the prices have already gone up. If you really care about the poor, you would get rid of government. You would get rid of all these government programs. You would get rid of the central banks who are making them through inflation, really. And you're seeing that all the time. Look at it's so I can't believe people don't see what's going on. You look at the U.S. and you have a lot of people and they can't survive on minimum wage, which, you know, a lot of these minimum wage jobs. If I hope that that's not the sort of the last, you know, I hope people aren't trying to raise a family of four on that or anything, but the reason these are coming up is because of, first of all, the price inflation because of the money printing. And so the prices in the economy are going up faster than wages are going up, and that's very normal. And you just see people saying, well, we need to raise the minimum wage again. But no one really asks, why do we always have to raise the minimum wage? Why are prices always going up? No one asks these questions. No one looks at the real root of the problem. It's all this money printing.
Which is driving inflation.
Right. Yes.
And if we weren't printing so much money, what you're saying is then we wouldn't have so much inflation and prices would be more stable, and then it would stop the mess that's going on, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and it would actually improve the lives. It would because this inflation always benefits the powerful and the rich because they get the money first. And also, a lot of rich people have assets like stocks or gold or whatever it is. And those assets tend, just like the stock market today, they tend to go up either faster than inflation or with inflation. Whereas by the time that someone on the poor person gets the money, all the prices in the economy have already risen. So that's why they always find that they can never keep up. If it's just constantly the price inflation. So if you want to help poor people, get rid of government, get rid of central banks, right there, there would be so much wealth in the economy again, because all this, almost half of everyone's money is just taken and mostly destroyed by the government and bureaucrats and just wasted on all kinds of paper pushing, stupid, actually wealth destroying things. And if people had that money, a lot of people would be almost make twice as much money all of a sudden. That would create an economy that would just be unbelievable. There would be no poor people very quickly. There'd be an amazing amount of opportunity. If you had double
But can
money,
you say that? I mean, as an example, we were chatting just before the interview. I lived in the Dominican Republic before I came back to the U.S., and I was down there for 10 years. You're right now in Acapulco. You don't really have there was no real government in the Dominican Republic. I mean, there was, but not really. So I consider it to be more or less a libertarian-type environment. You don't have much government, I imagine, where you are, but there's got to be a lot of poor people around.
Well, there's a lot of different sides to that. Really, what the biggest problem in those countries are, including Mexico, is private property rights. If you don't, if the society in general does not respect private property rights, then it's almost impossible to create a very prosperous society. So, this is one of the things that, and that's why the England and the U.S. did so well for so many years, because they actually had a system in place, a common law system that protected private property rights, and everyone sort of believed and bought into that system. So if you don't have private property rights, it's very almost impossible really to have a decent economy. And in so many places like Mexico, Dominican Republic, not many people buy much stuff because they know that someone can just take it, the government can just take it. There's just not a confidence. So, and then the second part is, you, of course, if you want to be a prosperous society, you have to be very productive. And in a lot of these places, I spent a lot of time in the Dominican Republic, and a lot of people are just sitting around and just smoking weed and drinking all day. And of course, that's not going to create a very, they're not going to be very wealthy, but that's their choice. Of course, you need to have productive people. You can't, if you just get rid of government and you just get rid of central banks and the people aren't, first of all, they don't respect private property rights, so everyone just starts stealing from everybody. And second of all, they're not very productive. Yeah, it's not going to look very good. But if you have those sort of things in place, then things would dramatically improve.
Okay. And I apologize for bringing so many left-wing points into this. I promise to beat myself for a couple of hours after this interview is finished. It's not like me at all, believe me. So you've been working on some interesting projects. One of them is Galt's Gulch down in Chile. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. The idea that I had a few years ago was I was just like in Ayn Rand's book Atlas Shrugged. The governments of the world are just getting so oppressive, the Western governments especially, and they're taxing a lot and regulations. They're actually making it almost impossible to be productive in the West right now. They're shutting down companies every day. In the book Atlas Shrugged, a lot of the producers just went on strike. So they said, that's enough. I'm not going to keep working like this when most of my money's taken from me and I'm just being constantly bombarded with regulations. And they all went to a place called Galt's Gulch, which happened to be in Colorado at the time when the book was written in the 1950s. But a lot's changed since then. And so now what I'm telling people is to get out of the Western world. I think it's definitely on a downward slide, and it's going to just continue to get worse until it finally collapses. The financial system will collapse. The monetary system will collapse. The government might collapse, which is good, but before they totally collapse, they'll probably take a lot of people down with it. It'll be much more of a police state. These things tend to go over and over in history. For example, throughout history, so many governments have gone under. So many currencies have been hyperinflated into nothing. Before these governments totally collapse, they usually try to steal as much as they can from their own citizens. And you can see that happening in the U.S. right now. They're just taking more and more, and they'll continue to do that. So what I tell people is to look at the rest of the world. There's parts of the world and entire regions that are doing incredibly well, and no one seems to know about it. Parts of Asia have done very well. Parts of Latin America have done incredibly well. Chile is one of them. Their economy is booming. Mexico is doing quite well. Their stock exchange is up, I believe, 500% in the last 10 years. They might be privatizing the oil oil industry right now, which is great. That will really help. And it's just funny to see because in the U.S. they're nationalizing things and nationalizing healthcare. And a lot of people say, oh, Mexico, it's a poor place and, it's corrupt and poor. There is some poverty here for sure. And there is some corruption, but it's doing very well. There's actually more Mexicans leaving the U.S. now than going to the U.S. And they usually give two reasons. One is there's not much economic possibilities up there anymore. It's just not possible to really get ahead. And number two, there's just no freedoms. You're just constantly getting pulled over and checked and scanned, and everything's being surveillance. And it's just really, it's definitely not the land of the free anymore. So it's very interesting, these other parts of the world. So I'm looking into trying to get started up communities of like-minded people, expats from around the world who want to escape from where they're from and go somewhere in some of these other countries, which I think have so much more potential and they're so much more free. There's one in Chile, Galt Skulls Chile, that I was involved in, helped to get found. And I'm looking at other places as well. I think it's a real growth industry. There's a lot of people that's really want to, getting pretty close to wanting to shrug, as they called it in Atlas Shrugged. It's time to get out and try to find a new life somewhere else and find a bit more freedom and possibly more prosperity by going to some of these other areas.
When I read Atlas Shrugged, that was a turning point in my life. Like I wasn't very good at making money before I read that book, and then suddenly that switched my brain on, and then making money actually became quite easy. I actually went to Cuba after I read it because I was like, I have to see what this looks like. Have you ever been there?
Yes, I've been to Havana.
And it was amazing. I mean, it was you can actually see the original Bacardi building, which is in downtown Havana, and it's now converted into government offices or something else. It's just incredible. I also then went to North Korea, and I also went to Myanmar or Burma. When you see the extreme forms of all of these, it's so clear how this totalitarianism stuff just messes everything up.
Yeah, totally. I've been to Myanmar as well. The only place I haven't been that you mentioned was North Korea. I don't know if I would survive very well there. I have a hard time keeping my mouth shut. It's just, bringing back your prior leftist points that you were bringing up about why there's poverty and which sort of system is better to actually make a much more prosperous society. If you just look at which countries on earth have the least government, have the least taxes, have the least regulations, they're all at the they're all top countries. They're all much freer and much richer than the U.S. Hong Kong, Singapore, all these kind of countries are at the top of the list. And then you look at the bottom of the list, and it's for least freedom and least prosperity, and it's North Korea, Cuba, Myanmar. Although that's changing now. But it's just so obvious. If you just look at the world, if you look at West Germany versus East Germany, West was more free. Look at that. East was more communist. Look at how that turned out. North Korea versus South Korea. It's pretty clear which is where I'd rather live. I don't know many people who would choose North Korea over South Korea. It's just obvious. The more freedom that people have, the more prosperous it is and the better it is. But for some reason, people keep thinking that, well, maybe we can just a little bit of government, or just we do need some welfare, and then it just gets worse and worse from there. Just let the market take care of itself. The best thing we can do for poor people is to set them free and allow them to make money. And so many of the government central bank systems today don't allow them to do that.
You know, growing up in Australia as a kid, I mean, we were far from. You were in Canada, so you were at least close to the U.S. and had more of a feel of what's happening. And mm-hmm. in Australia, like the U.S. just seemed like I didn't ever understand this concept of liberty, but it seemed like they were more free, and it was where all the exciting stuff's happening. And it makes me really sad. I really used to have a lot of admiration for the U.S. and it's fading away a lot.
Oh, definitely, and it's going to get worse. Oh yeah, no, it's going down. I just met actually with two people last night here in Acapulco. They're from Houston, and they actually been living the last 40 years in Saudi Arabia. Very interesting people. And they were telling me that they were just back in the U.S. and they hadn't been there in a decade, and they were just in shock. They couldn't believe what they were seeing. And I totally understand what they're saying. A lot of these things tend to happen kind of just day by day. It gets a little worse. But if you haven't seen it in 10 years or since before 9/11, and you go to the U.S. now, it's shocking to see, you know, those SWAT teams running around, tanks, and you show up and everyone's got, you know, you're getting searched everywhere. It's unbelievable. And yeah, it's really going to be very interesting to see what happens in the U.S. I really advise people just to get as far away from the U.S. as possible. It's not going to be good. Even just watching the Super Bowl weekend here, they've just half the news is about the security for it, and they're going to have no fly zones, and it's like, what kind of crazy place is this where, like, a lot of the talk about the game is just about the security and they're gonna have snipers in the stadium? It's like, what the hell? Like, what is this? yeah, it's just a bizarre. It's getting more and more strange up there. I really just prefer to stay out of there. Every time I go to the U.S., I almost say I'm never coming back, because it's just, it's not worth it. It used to be a special place, and now it's just another nation state, and not a very good one at that. And a lot of other places are a lot more free. So I prefer to stay in a place like Mexico, which is freer, a lot freer, or in almost name any other country. They're almost all freer and better, freer lifestyle, and live outside of that. And there's a lot of opportunity out here too. So the real growth happening in the world is not happening in the U.S. or the Western world. It's happening in a lot of these developing countries, and I think that's just so exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I like to reserve my right to be an idiot at times, and, you know, as you put all these restrictions on everything, you lose those rights, and it just takes away part of the stuff of being fun, but it also takes away a lot of our humanity.
Yeah, I totally agree. I see it all the time, and it's really bizarre to see Americans, how they act. You go to the U.S. now, and man, there's disclaimers everywhere, signs, everyone's checking and making sure, because we got to make sure that Joey can't buy some cigarettes that's, you know, 18 years old or 17 years old, or he can't buy a beer when he's 20. So we got to have, like, surveillance, we got to have regulations and signs, and we got to have the cops come around and check. It's just brutal. Just let Joey do whatever he wants. And that's why I really like a place like Mexico. There's really no rules at all when it comes to stuff like that. Just do whatever you want, as long as you don't hurt anybody. And it's just, you're right. It makes you feel like you're living in like a robot up there in the U.S. And everyone gets all scared of everything all the time, because they've been trained that the government and the society is going to make sure that nothing bad ever happens. So they get really wrapped up in stuff like that. I'll give you like two examples down here in Mexico. I've had some American clients come down, and one of them said, "I can't believe it. There's no speed limits." And I said, "What's wrong with that?" And they said, "That's terrible. That's dangerous." And I was like, "Well, speed limits have nothing to do with safety. You can have speed recommendations, but actually having a police pull you over and give you extort you for money because you were driving a little too fast is a crazy idea." But they're really wrapped up about, well, we need these things. And
well, the best example there is Germany and the autobahns, where they don't have speed limits.
Yeah, well, that's even changing now too. There's parts of the autobahn now where they have speed limits. I was just there, and it's terrible. It causes unbelievable commotion, because people go from going very fast to all of a sudden all having to hit the brakes, and so they don't get a ticket, and it just causes total chaos. But yeah, it's amazing how people think. For example, down here, we were walking once with some Americans, and there was a fairly large hole in the sidewalk. And I've seen that hole. It's been there for about 5 years. And they went, "That's terrible." And I said, "What?" And they said, they need to put up some sort of barrier around this hole or fix that hole. Someone could fall into it. And that's their mindset, is that these things, we have to make everything as safe as possible.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was just saying to them, well, just don't fall in the hole. Like, right. You see the hole there, right? And they're like, "Well, what if I was blind?" It's like, well, you know, like, what are we going to do? Like, make everything into just, it's unbelievable how, like, there's just this mindset that we have to make everything as safe as possible. And, you know, I don't want to live in a world where everything is as safe as possible.
I... Yeah, you're expressing exactly the things that I felt coming back here. I mean, it's New York City, walking around New York when I first got back and was living here. It's like, this is Disneyland. You can just like walk around on the street and everything's, I mean, and people say New York's dangerous, which I haven't seen at all. They're saying it's, you can just walk around and it's like everything is, it's all planned and organized like Disneyland. Whereas in the Caribbean, you know, you got to watch yourself or you get your ass kicked. It's not safe, but you know, you learn what is safe and you learn what isn't, and then you do those things and then you're fine. And exactly like that with the holes. I just want to ask you, so you're in Acapulco, you obviously don't have a massive workforce that you can hire to do big projects there. How do you gain scale in what you do?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Why can't I hire a massive workforce?
I mean, you can obviously have teams working remotely and working on stuff, which I'm sure you're doing. But I mean, if you wanted to build a company with 100 or 1,000 people really working on stuff, face-to-face really matters. And you lose, I mean, you know, I know that. I've done that for 10 years, and I know that there's real problems with not being face-to-face a fair amount of the time. How do you manage that? How do you get scale?
Oh, I understand. Yeah. Well, I've always been an internet guy, and so... And so many people today are as well. I think it's getting easier and easier to work remotely. It's something that people just have to get more and more used to. But you're definitely right. Face-to-face is very important. And we do have definitely dozens of people working for us around the world. Probably, I don't think any two of them are in the same country. There's one in Cambodia and Canada and all over the place, Dubai. And yeah, we try to get together. You know, once a year or whatever, and Skype video calls help a lot. But you're right, it is difficult to build a company that's almost completely virtual and doesn't really have an office. But I think if you find the right people, and that's important, very entrepreneurial style people, and you give them the right incentives, that I think that's fine. I wouldn't want to work in an office, even if that made a lot of sense. I wouldn't do it. I'm sitting here in Acapulco, basically on the beach. In my house, which I have a home office, it's pretty comfortable. I don't want to do that commute, and it's just the whole idea of being in an office, really, I don't like. But yeah, it's different. I think a lot of things are changing. I think a lot of the technologies are making things a lot easier now. But it definitely, you're right, it's difficult. It's not easy to work remotely and not see the other person ever. And I actually have numerous people who work for me I've never met in person.
Hmm. Yeah, it's an issue of scale. I mean, that's the reason I came back to the U.S. was to be able to build something big, but then there's a trade-off because I'm here in New York City in the land of the free, which is obviously not so free anymore. And so, do I want that scalability or do I want to go and live somewhere that's a lot more pleasant?
Yeah, it all depends what you want to do, of course. I don't know what kind of company you want to build, but I think those things are totally possible and much easier to do in a lot of other countries now than it is in New York. Trying to start a company in New York, forget about it. It's just, I wouldn't even want to go through the paperwork to try to start something up and the health inspections and the insurance and all that kind of stuff. I have a hotel here in Mexico. There's no company, there's no employees, I just pay people like contractors. It's so much easier. You just start it up. I started a condo sales company. I just started it up and it just does sales, and I don't need a real estate license or anything like that. So I actually find it's a lot easier to build companies, a lot easier outside of the Western countries and in countries like Mexico or Chile or countless others.
Hmm. Interesting. All right. Is there anything else you want to cover which we haven't talked about?
No, I think that was very good. I really don't have much more to say.
I apologize again for bringing up my left wing side, but yeah, I had to do it.
That's okay. Yeah, that's okay.
We're still friends?
Oh, yeah. No, it's fine.
All right, Jeff. Well, thanks very much for doing the interview.
Okay, thank you, Adrian.